You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble. Hello, and welcome to episode 7 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Cookie.
And I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
We've got so many lovely, lovely things to talk about this week. I think, though, what I'd like to first start on was the sort of Wii U launch announcement stuff that sort of exploded onto the internet last week.
Yes, sorry.
Who was that made that noise?
That was me.
Surprisingly, it wasn't me.
Yeah, I was wondering what was going on there for a minute. If we got how many Nintendo fanboys are on the call?
It depends how you refer to a fanboy. I'm a Nintendo fan.
Same here. I like Nintendo stuff. I have a Wii. I have a DS. I don't have a 3DS, but
I've got a 3DS.
Oh. There we go.
I have played Nintendo stuff before. The Wii sort of sat there and collected dust, so that got shirked out. DS we still got, and I still play occasionally on that. I used to love the SNES.
So that's because the SNES was awesome, that's why.
I wouldn't say I was a hardcore fan, but I do like what Nintendo do, and I do love the Mario games. Mario Galaxy 2 is just awesome.
I think that I'm not particularly excited about any of the launch games.
No, that's what I was going to say, apart from Bayonetta 2.
But then that's on launch game. It's not coming out to apparently something like March next year.
But at least we're getting a sequel. Hurrah!
I'm looking forward to Zombie U.
That actually looks quite fun. Yeah, I have to say.
I'm looking forward
Pikmin
to...
Pikmin
3. Ooh.
Yes.
Has that been...
What do you mean, ooh?
Oh. I started trying to play the game and gave up, and that was the Wii version with the Wiimote controls.
I'll have to say Pikmin 2, which they haven't released a rejigged Wii version of it yet, have they? I've got the Wii version of the first one, but I played it through on the GameCube, so I just picked it up cheap, but I've not played it. But Pikmin 2 I spent something like 60 hours on.
Cool.
It is a very nice game, surprisingly so. So I am actually really looking forward to Pikmin 3 on the Wii U, but the actual Wii U itself...
Yeah, I was going to say the Wii U itself is a bit... But saying that, the pricing for a new console doesn't seem too harsh.
I have to admit, one thing that I'm actually looking forward to is being able to play on the 360 while I play on the Wii U on the control pad.
Yes,
that'd be cool.
That's a nice little feature, but
it is a nice little feature, isn't it? I mean, it's... I think I'm going to just have to see what the games actually look like and play like on it, to be fair, because a lot of the games are already coming out for the existing consoles. So, you know, to shell out, was it $249 for the basic pack?
Something like that, yeah, depending on which game.
Which I wouldn't want anyway, because it doesn't come with any games or anything. If I was going to buy it, it'd be the full-on...
Yeah, that's what I'm planning on getting.
That's the thing, isn't it? Pretty much, us lot here, we'd take one look at the two packages, and it would be, well, I want the one with everything in the box. I want the one with the Wii sensor and everything like that, and the extra storage. Why would you go for the lower one if... You know, if you've got the option between
the
two.
I think that the Xbox 360's various SKUs have taught us is that if you go for the lower end one, you're going to regret it.
Yeah, you're going to end up spending money left, right, and centre anyway to actually use it properly once you've got it there.
With you mentioning the 360 there, shall I just lay down on the table my issues with the Wii U at the moment?
Oh, please do.
Go on then.
Right. Well, in January 2006, which was when the 360 was pretty much... You could walk into a shop and actually buy the console, rather than walk into a shop and ask if they had any, and no, they didn't, which it had been up until then. When I first bought mine, 20 gig model, 360, the premium model, of course, it was $299, and you know and was a nice upgrade over the Xbox and the PS2, and the GameCube. Now, you're looking at 6 years later. Actually, it'll be about 7 years later, won't it? By the time you can actually walk into a shop and actually buy one on a decent availability. And they're asking almost the same price for hardware, which is barely more powerful. It's got more RAM, and it's got a nice controller. And that's it.
I think that's my issue with it.
The other thing I've got the issue with is it's only, got 32 gig of memory on it? Well, my Xbox is nearly full, and it's got a 250 gig hard drive on it. So how is that going to compare if it's going to be next gen?
They obviously don't expect you to do game installs. I think you couldn't expect people to game install, surely.
To be fair, though, Nintendo have never done that. So you don't really need to install a game in order to make it work faster.
Yeah, but the only reason I ever install Xbox games isn't because I'm worried about it running faster. I'm actually worried about the longevity of the disk drive.
Yes. That's why I installed it on there.
Yeah, because I play 360 so much when I do play any games.
Although, to be fair, Nintendo's hardware has always been top-notch.
It has.
Yeah. If they're going to be more reliable.
But on the same token, if they want to make the Nintendo shop as successful as Xbox Live Arcade and PlayStation Network with the indie titles and all that, there is going to become a point where 32 gig, is it really going to be enough?
I think that you can use other external memory with it, can't you?
Yeah, I believe so.
You can use hard drives and pen SD drives, cards. But I'm not entirely sure if, you know, in what way. It's like with the Wii. You could plug an SD card in, you could pop that in, but initially you could only copy things to and from it. You couldn't actually use it for game storage. Yeah. They did change that with an update.
They did.
So it's up in the air whether they'll do it that way. But with the Wii, it's got a 25 gig optical drive, hasn't it? So it's pretty much a custom type in a slightly tweaked Blu-ray drive.
Yeah.
By the sounds of it. So it's probably going to run relatively slowly. So it's not going to be that loud because of the data density on the disc.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why a lot of people install games on their 360s, to shut the disk drive up.
That is true. Yeah.
Which is kind of ironic because even when you've got stuff installed, it still seems to, doing the disk drive.
It's only for for a little while after you've booted up the game, though. And then it just kind of quiets down, at least it does for me.
No, it does. I've noticed that it's with the more recent games. I've got Fallout New Vegas installed on the hard drive. The disc never spins up, but on the things like Gears 3, which use the slightly rejigged disc format with the extra 1 gig of storage or thereabouts, they do spin up and they run for about a minute, and then they shut down on the 360. And I'm not entirely sure why, but yeah, that's just what I've noticed.
I would say the thing that I'm not liking about the Wii U, I'm just not understanding, is the whole sort of controller, how do you call it, tablet? Is it a tablet?
The cheap iPad with controls.
I think about the fact that that's probably actually making up a huge amount of the cost of the overall console. And then think about the fact that they could have delivered either a cheaper console or something that had a more traditional controller system, or used a slightly amped up version of what the Wii's got.
A more traditional controller, which they are releasing for the Wii U.
Yeah, but at the same time, you're buying the Wii U with the thingy pad anyway, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that the base unit, you've got the whole load of the cost of the base unit is wound up in this thing that you don't necessarily need. And actually, they could have just forsaken trying to be a bit gimmicky again.
Yeah.
And just concentrated on making a far more solid and I'm not saying power is everything, but they could have amped up the specs a bit more.
Yeah. Well,
they could have done.
The thing is with the Wii U is that it does have 2 gig of RAM, which is a nice upgrade. It's 4 times the RAM that's in the 360 and the PS3.
Yes.
Which means it can do more at once. But the other issues are, I can't remember the resolution of the screen on the controller, but I know it's not Retina or anything like that. But I do know it's not a machine in its own right. It basically, it's a dumb terminal.
Mm.
All the processing for anything that appears on the tablet is done by the Wii U.
Yes.
Yeah, it's basically a wireless screen in a way.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's a pressure-sensitive touch screen. Mm. It's not capacitive like everyone is used to with their phones and the iPads and everything like that. So people are going to notice that
the
it's
different.
Because there'll be a lot of people who will see it and they'll think, oh, it's got an iPad with game controls on the side and you can use it like that. And imagine what we can do with an iPad. So, yeah, you can do a lot of things with an iPad and Android tablets, but you're not really going to be able to do all of those with the Wii U controller.
No.
So you can calm down. Please calm down, because otherwise you'll just be very disappointed when you get your hands on one.
I just want to reiterate, though, I am looking forward to Bayonetta 2, because I absolutely adored the first game.
Bayonetta 2 is going to be ace.
I've only played about the first mission of that. I should really go back to it.
It is really good.
I got paid to write a complete walkthrough for the game.
Awesome.
But the interesting thing was that once you started playing up the hard difficulties, in a way it became easier. Were the ones that still allowed witch time. So it'll be interesting to see if they still keep it. But I don't think it's going to be a Wii U exclusive, like a Wii U exclusive. I do suspect it's going to go the way of Resident Evil 4. Because Sega still retains the license.
It's going to be a, like only on Xbox used to be, where it was only on Xbox until about 6 months later.
Yeah.
Mm. Or, you know, so many months later, and then it appears in the other formats anyway.
Although, to be fair, I mean, it's, in a way, the Wii U's got an advantage because of its unique control scheme. Basically means that whatever they do with the Wii U control, they're not necessarily going to be able to replicate that on the other consoles.
True.
Apart from on the PS3 with the Vita.
Yes.
Does the Vita have on the front touchscreen controls?
Yes.
Yes.
And it's got touchscreen on the back.
It's touchscreen on the front and it's got a touchpad on the back, as well as having dual analog. And the Vita is nice hardware. It's just, the price. And the price,
Vita,
and the price of the games.
I have got a Vita and I absolutely adore it, I must admit.
Oh, but it is really nice hardware.
I just want more games for it. I don't see a reason
to have one yet.
I just want more games for it. That's all I want.
I want more games and for them to be cheaper.
I think we've exhausted Wii U there for the minute. Apart from that, Dad, what's the launch date? I can't remember now.
Oh, in the UK, I believe it's around the 30th of November.
Yes. Cool. Yes.
And I will say, well, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to playing with it at the Eurogamer Expo.
Hmm.
I'm not even considering pre-ordering it.
No, I'm not. I'm going to wait and see what happens.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Okay, I think I'm going to be pre-ordering it. Well, yeah, we'll let you know what it's like.
Yeah, no, that's
please
fair.
Do.
Yeah, please do. No, that'd be great.
Because I mean, even though it's a bit pricey for what it is, it's still new hardware, and I'm still a geek.
Yeah,
I still want my hands on one.
Yes, I'm still fascinated by it.
Yeah,
see what
it
does. Definitely.
Moving on. A Deadpool Gangnam Style music video parody or tribute. Homage has turned up on YouTube. It's a guy who seems to be obsessed of cosplaying as Deadpool, has gone around imitating Psy's top 100 music video. And remember, the only reason that you should like this Gangnam Style, the original, is the fact that it's beating Justin Bieber.
I approve.
To be fair, it's not the only. It's probably not the only reason.
Okay, it is actually a bit catchy, that too. And the dance move's actually quite doable when you think about it. Yes. It's less complicated than a lot of the dance moves in various Just Dance tracks, I would say.
You just kind of want to get a line of people doing it all at the same time.
I want to get a line of people doing that in a Cornish town, because nobody will know what the hell is going on. But anyway, the actual Deadpool video has basically got this guy reenacting the video, quite, in some instances, sort of scene for scene. And it looks actually quite fun. And I will be including links to the video in the actual post to go along with this podcast.
It's actually quite amusing when you watch it.
Mm.
And, you know, for the actual character of Deadpool, it does make sense to do that sort of thing with Deadpool, because he is that wacky in the comic books, which is quite nice.
It'll be cool to have like a tie-in thing with one of his comics.
Yeah. It would be cool if he did it in one of the comics. Though, yeah. I'm pretty sure Deadpool's been, not that I've been keeping up with Deadpool Marvel comics at the moment, but I'm pretty sure Deadpool has been killing a lot of people lately, character-wise. Or I could just be misreading some of the headlines that I've seen blaring out on me that I haven't clicked through on.
It's what he does best.
This is what happens when you listen to The Onion.
Ben Affleck again. He's finally admitted he didn't like Daredevil.
Shock horror. Which is fair enough. I mean, kudos to him to actually admitting it. Most people wouldn't admit it, would they? Not being funny.
Well, I mean, the funny thing about, you know, films in general is that, you know, even though Ben Affleck was Daredevil, there's so many people behind the film. And you never know exactly how it's going to turn out until it actually turns out. So, you know, you could read the script, you could really like it, you could do everything absolutely right, and if you don't have a good editor, or if you don't have a good director or producer,
or the studio interference with the editing,
then it could be just dire. Yeah. So the star has no control over that aspect, so can completely kind of understand.
Yeah, and like I say, for him to actually stand up and admit that he was, you know, he didn't like making it and it was crap, then kudos to him.
I mean, I believe Paul Verhoeven actually said that, Showgirls. Showgirls, yes, that's one. He thought that was a mistake after he had made it. But you just can't, you know, hindsight's 2020, as they say.
How exactly do you know? There may be a lot of things that, it seems like a good idea at the time, and it could work, and we could do this, and we could do that, and those didn't work.
Well, the thing is, though, so in the case of Halle Berry and Catwoman,
oh dear God,
don't forget that I do believe it was her agent that got her the gig. She didn't actually read the script before accepting. And the thing with Daredevil is that if you watch the director's cut, it's certainly improved.
Yes, it makes
so
a lot more sense.
So if Affleck hasn't watched the director's cut. Well, moving on. There's been a hint of what the new Robocop costume looks like.
Crap.
I'm not sure if it's actually what it looks like. I mean, okay, so it's a bit hard to chroma key black, but I can't help but think there's going to be a lot added to it in post production.
I hope so.
I'm hoping you're right and not just being very optimistic.
If people are aware, currently Robocop's costume is completely black all over. It kind of looked like Kevlar body armor had been kind of stuck everywhere.
Looks like a cat suit gone wrong.
Is just a question, is this like on film kind of on set kind of costume?
It's an on set photo, but so the costume was completely black. They were on a street scene. I think you could just about see his face in one of the photos, like the.
Is it a possibility that this may be actually misconstrued and it's actually one scene where like he's got his body armor removed or something like that, and this what's kind of underneath? Or
I didn't because it looks like it looked kind of less cool than like Batman's suit in the Nolan films.
It looks like he's actually walking down the street as well, doesn't it?
It looked like some sort of weird panelized combat thing.
They must be doing something within post production, or
I hope so, because it looks crap.
At the same time, it does look naff, so they better be doing something. I'm not saying they have to make it silvery and shiny like the original film, which I started rewatching recently and fell asleep during. I do like the original, but it's hard for me to watch films after 10 at night after I've had 3 beers.
Oh, that's fair.
Yeah, you were exhausted.
I'll just very quickly say that I can understand them wanting to set it apart from the original look of RoboCop, but there's a lot you could do to the suit to make it look different and yet...
Actually, make it like a Zion still.
Recognizable. You could do a lot with it. You could make it look far more detailed and less just sort of like panel metal like the original one did.
Or more modelled on actual physiology.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You could have a lot more sort of gears and you know things like that on it. Well, not gears, but you know, like pumps and you know, instead of muscles. There's a lot you could do, and I'm hoping that they do, and I'm hoping that's not the final thing.
So do I, to be fair. I mean, I think the only thing I saw that was original was the red LED stripe going across the visor from the original.
Okay. Mm. Who here has heard of 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon, or who hasn't, actually, might be?
I have not heard of it, no.
I'll be honest, I have not heard of it.
I can't remember which magazine it was, if it was either SFX or somebody else. It was UK Mag, certainly, but they tended to run a feature every month that was 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. And basically, because Kevin Bacon has been in an insane amount of films, over something like 78 films or something, trying to find an actor that is distantly connected with Kevin Bacon, if this is an actor that's even just appeared in just sort of like something on the BBC but nothing in Hollywood, even if it's just them, the degrees of connection are tiny. Basically, if you can find somebody who's more than 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, I think you've basically like won life. If you can find an actor that's more than 6 degrees, and we're talking, well, I can't use the term proper actors, but actors that have, who actually do act for a living and are perhaps what one might call commercial successes. So I searched David Jason, and using Google's new 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon feature. Basically, you put in Kevin Bacon space number, as in the word number space, and then the actor or actress's name that you want to check out. So I put in David Jason. It was 2 degrees. 2 degrees of connection away from Kevin Bacon. That's David Jason. Cool.
So hang on, right, Google.
Yeah, you go search for somebody.
Right, carry on.
It's not even like it brings up a link. It actually brings up, you know, like how Google will bring up calculations. Like if you go convert something into something, it'll bring up stuff to do with that. It's not bringing up like a proper thing like that, but for Kevin Bacon and his connections to the world actors and actresses. And I assume that maybe the only way you can really get around this is if you do actors and actresses who aren't from... who aren't mainly involved in English-speaking films. Might be a way around it.
I've just done it.
Uh-huh.
Right, Kevin Bacon, number, Felicia Day.
How close?
Yes, I know. Two.
Two as well.
So I've just done it.
Felicia Day and Matt O'Leary appeared in Warm Springs.
Mm-hmm.
Matt O'Leary and Kevin Bacon appeared in Death Sentence.
Yeah. And I've just done Kevin Bacon number Matt Smith for the Doctor.
Yeah.
And we've got two.
Everyone's two. That's it, because I can't...
Darville. Try Arthur Darville.
Arthur Darville, okay.
Although, to be fair, that's going to be three maximum, isn't it?
Because appeared in Doctor Who with Matt Smith. Matt Smith was, yeah.
What's his name?
Two.
Oh. God. Somebody think of a non-English or American actor or actress and then try that. But not Penelope Cruz.
Oh, don't just type that.
Because that probably will be close.
Salma Hayek, her name is.
Or possibly an actor
that's died. So say for example, type in Bruce Lee. See, or even better,
Jason Lee.
Like not Jason Lee, Brandon Lee.
Bruce Lee's bacon number is 2.
Brandon Lee. Oh, will be as well.
Brandon Lee, let's have a look. Is 3.
Found a 3. Oh my goodness.
Brandon Lee and Michael Mass appeared in The Crow. Michael Mass and Crespin appeared in Corky Romano. And Chris Penn and Kevin Bacon appeared in Footloose.
Basically, for those of you who could never be bothered to troll hundreds of pages of IMDb, this new Google function is for you if you wish to play 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. Of course, now the challenge genuinely is finding someone outside the 6 degrees.
Yeah, you've got to beat 3 so far.
I've just put one in. Kevin Bacon, Charlie Chaplin. The number is 2.
Oh, hey.
Really?
What's the links? What are the links?
Charlie Chaplin and Tippi Hedren appeared in A Countess from Hong Kong. Tippi Hedren and Kevin Bacon appeared in James Mansfield's Car.
Oh my lord! Oh.
Elvis Presley is number 2 as well.
Okay. I think
this is insane.
I don't know what I've introduced people to now.
Tweet your best answers.
Yeah, tweet us your best answers. There you go.
Or post on Facebook. What's the highest separation from Kevin Bacon you can find for any actress or actor? Moving on to what we really wanted to talk to you about this week. I'm not sure what's inspired this. I think it's probably the fact that Doctor Who's returned to our screens. But I wanted all of us to have a chance to talk about our favourite sci-fi TV shows. Now, before we go into ours, I did manage to find out from... Well, I hope there are a couple of listeners. Either that or they just like tweeting or Facebooking to us for no good reason. But Owen said his fave shows are Doctor Who, Quantum Leap, Blake 7, Star Trek, the original Battlestar Galactica, and early X-Files, and admits that he has a guilty pleasure of watching Sliders. And I asked him, like, how many seasons has he got up to on Sliders? Because Sliders, yeah, well, I'm sure Paul might cover that in a bit. Owen said about Sliders, chronology doesn't exist for me within the Sliders universe. They turn up somewhere and do shit, and it's all very enjoyable.
I'd have to agree with that.
It's a little bit like Quantum Leap in that way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, for the first, 3 seasons, after that, then it gets a bit more linear.
And we've got one other response, and this is from Andrew, and he said his favourite show was Space Above and Beyond. Now, this is interesting, only because going back to when we would talk about the Back to Frank Black guys from a few weeks ago, one of the hosts for their podcast, the Brit that does it, he's always lamented the fact that Space Above and Beyond has been available on DVD, I believe. I just wanted to tell him, if he ever listens to this, ever, that it is actually available on DVD in the UK now, but it's only happened in like less than a year that it's actually been available.
So, we win somehow.
Yes. Cool. Okay. All right. Now on to our... personal top fives. We're going to list each of our top fives, and then we're going to talk about basically what ended up becoming the gang's actual top five. So I'm going to go first. At number 5, I had Star Trek the Next Generation. Number 4, the new Doctor Who. Number 3, Firefly. 2, The X-Files. And number 1, Farscape. Paul B, what did you end up with?
Okay, well, before I progress, I'll just say that I've deliberately chosen series that other people haven't mentioned, or, you know, briefly kind of mentioned. So I'll go start with 5, Red Dwarf. Start with 4, Battlestar Galactica, new version. 3, Sliders. 2, Futurama. And 1, I've kind of combined new Doctor Who with Torchwood as well, because I do like Torchwood.
Mm-hmm.
What's happened to me?
Descent.
Are you judging me?
Not out loud.
That's terribly reassuring.
I actually quite enjoyed Torchwood until they went over to America and did it.
Yeah.
And I felt it lost a bit of its spark.
I would agree there.
Although Bill Pullman as the psychopathic killer was quite interesting.
Yes.
Original series done in the 80s, as in the miniseries, not the TV series. Different things, trust me. Number 2 would be Babylon 5. And 1, I had a hard choice here, so I put Firefly / Dollhouse, because they're both Joss Whedon.
Okay. Cookie, which yours?
Okay, so riding in at number 5, defending the Delta Quadrant, is Deep Space Nine. Number 4, making science go all mad, Fringe. Number 3, Babylon 5. Number 2, the one, the only, the best, Star Trek The Next Generation.
Great.
And number 1, flying his little blue box around time and space, Doctor Who. Yay!
As people might be able to notice, perhaps we do share some similar faves here. okay, yeah. So because it would take forever for us to each talk about each show, because that's like 20 TV shows with crossovers as well in terms of who we talk about what, we've basically come up now with a list of Nerds Assemble's top 5. And basically, out of all that, though, the one that's really number 1 is Star Trek The Next Generation, because it got mentioned the most.
Yes.
But I would like Cookie to talk about Doctor Who, and maybe we will interject appropriately.
Okay, fair enough. So, Doctor Who, I've loved since I was about 3 or 4. I can still remember watching Peter Davison on my telly at meal times. Bless. And I've just grown up with it. It's just a fascinating. I love all the science behind it. I love how he can go back in time. It's just one of those shows that really appeals to me. And the actual watching the Doctor progress as well. Like, you know, with Tom Baker doing it for 7 years, then you get the new reincarnation of Peter Davison, a fresh look, a fresh feel. Then you had the completely insane, nutty Colin Baker, who even hit one of his companions on the first episode. I remember quite vividly Perry getting sort of slapped, and I was like, ooh, blimey. He's not very nice.
To be fair, though, that was understandable.
you know, and it's just the whole lore behind the Time Lords and everything else, which has culminated in the new series, which has been done brilliantly. And I just like the fact that we're now getting to see his darker side as well. With Doctor Who ending in the 80s, we actually, for fans like me, we actually got a reprieve with a company called Big Finish Audio, who started doing Doctor Who plays. Audio plays, and they reunited all the original Doctors with their companions. So you've got Colin Baker with Perry, you've got Peter Davison with Perry Teague, and you've got Sylvester McCoy with Ace. And I found the way they actually matured the series brilliantly, and they just took the Doctor sort of into different scopes, and they explored bits which the TV didn't explore. One in particular, there was a title called The Master, which actually went into more depth about the Doctor's and the Master's relationship on Gallifrey and how they were best friends and why that friendship ended. And it showed such a more sort of darker side to the Doctor. And it's just interesting to see how this 900-year-old Time Lord is starting to get a little bit... You saw it on Saturday in the episode where he's getting a bit more dark and he's getting a bit more fed up of having to do the right thing all the time to let the... you know, to let the evil guys be judged rather than just let them die and stuff.
I did notice, was it me or did the Doctor say that his age was about 300 years more than like the previous series?
Yeah, it was.
It was me just kind of mixing
things. The last time I heard his age mentioned, he was something like maybe 900 or something, or 900 odd, and now he's suddenly of 1200.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, it is.
That's the beauty of a series like Doctor Who. You can just drop off the companions, and the companions say, "Oh, it's been a while since we've seen you, Doctor," but it could be far longer for him.
Mm.
We don't know what's happened in this time.
Exactly.
No,
I think we might be finding out what happened, but yeah.
Yes. But, I think that's the beauty of Moffat's writing, though. You know, the fact that he does do all this kind of integrate, you know, it's like the Doctor has aged and whatnot. It's not like Russell T. Davies, who basically just had it almost like every single episode, new adventure, and it's just kind of continuous without kind of breaks.
I mean, if you get that with the finished audios as well. I know I keep harping on about it, but you do get some of that crossing over into the old Time Lords. I mean, Colin Baker was never really my favourite one of my favourite Doctors. He always used
to
me. But since listening to him on Big Finish and actually listening to his character progress in the way that those writers want him to progress, he has actually become quite a strong Doctor in his own right, with his own little quirks and symbolisms that he's brought over from the TV series, but he's been able to develop a lot more for the audio plays. And it's just stuff like that that interests me. I mean, I've read the books. I can remember when I was young, I used to have rows and rows of Doctor Who videos. I even had the original Unearthly Child on video, which was actually quite good. So
I had some of the audiobooks, and it was mostly novel adaptations of stories.
Mm. Very good.
And there were some bloody good episodes,
yes.
Bloody good stories and adaptations, and I can see why an audio play format would work a lot better for Doctor Who, because then, especially with Colin Baker, that kind of era, you were really stuck with terrible budgets.
Yes.
And a real unwillingness to give them more.
Mm.
Because after all, it was only a kid's series, wasn't it? So why bother?
It couldn't be worse than Blake 7, though. I mean, reportedly, their budget was £50 an episode.
Oh, they just used the old Peter set,
I can believe it. Well, the thing I heard about Blake 7 was that Terry Nation went to the Beeb with the idea for the sci-fi series. And they were, but they can be quite pricey. If you can bring it in for around about the budget of, say, a TV soap.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Per episode. And it was
okay.
Yeah, and suddenly the ricketiness of Blake 7 makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
That the only way he could really get the BBC to commission the series was by making the promise that it wasn't going to be any more expensive than Crossroads.
And that's not a standard anyone wants to live up to.
No. So I feel a bit sorry for, you know, Blake 7 in that.
I just want to say, Doctor Who, I've never really seriously watched any of the old episodes. As I previously admitted, the only times I've seen any of the old stuff is when Paul's dad's been, like, watching collections on DVD of the older episodes. I haven't seen that many. But I do like the new stuff, though. I usually only like the episode for about 5 minutes after watching it, and I'm like, meh. Though I have actually been pleasantly surprised by this series so far. I've actually quite enjoyed the episodes. I was perhaps disappointed by the some of the events in that episode. I noticed a trend with one of the actors, which I won't say any more on because it would be a spoiler.
You see, now you've got me interested.
There is a link.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah. Retro, do you want to talk about the original V?
Hooray! Right, well, for anyone who has just seen the new series, completely ignore that. It's crap. So can now start? I've got that out of the way. The original miniseries of V, and I'd stretch it to include the final battle, which was a three-part, miniseries they did because of the success of the first two-part miniseries. The story was basically the same in that giant saucers appeared over Earth. And people were waiting to find out what on Earth was going on, whether they were invaded or not. And as it turned out, no, they were friends and they were lovely. And, oh, isn't it nice that they look so human? And they just want to help us. And they don't want anything in return. That's super. Nothing can possibly go wrong with that. My, how stylish their uniforms are. Just like the Nazis were.
And space Nazis. Yes.
So, as it turned out, you had the TV reporter and you had the scientist, the lady scientist, which was a little bit more unusual in the, you know, the early 80s. And instead of it being a question of, or it's almost religion, isn't it, with the new series?
Yeah.
Where they have the priest character. He's new. Ignore him. The original series was all about they appeared on Earth. They appeared to offer incredible new technologies and just help and generally being lovely, because isn't being friends nice, children? And then the scientists were looking at them and thinking, well, how can an alien species look so much like us? So they'd be taking measurements, and then all of a sudden those scientists would disappear. And they'd return, and suddenly their opinions would be completely changed. Their behaviours would be completely changed, and they'd be left-handed instead of right-handed and things like that. And one of the families in the original miniseries, again, partially replicated in the new one with what's her face, who played Juliet in Lost, her stupid idiot son. Their family had grandparents, and the family was Jewish. And the grandfather and grandmother had been in the camps under the Nazis, and they were pointing out just how close it was that these people were, you know, coming along, and they were offering help. And they were just wanting to root out those troublemakers in society, like the scientists who were suddenly causing trouble. And as it turned out, the visitors were saying, well, they've had these cures for cancer and all these different diseases for years, and yet they've been keeping them from the population. Isn't that disgraceful? And the tide of opinion would turn against the scientists, who, of course, were the only people who could work out who and what the visitors were. And what they were doing on Earth. So it was a whole just turning public opinion against science so they could get away with the occupation, which is what it was obvious by the end of the first miniseries. It was. The visitors were inserting themselves into society, making people depend on them, and just making little things happen, taking advantage of people's optimism, and making themselves indispensable. Now, that is why the original miniseries was so excellent. Plus, the scene where Mark Singer manages to get himself onto one of the saucers. Mark Singer playing the reporter, investigative reporter in the original. And he gets himself onto one of the saucers. He's in the air ducts, and he sees, I think it's Diana, eat. It's either a guinea pig. And it's, yes, it's an incredibly cheap 1980s badly done special effect, but she holds the guinea pig over her face, and then she dislocates her jaw like a snake and then just stuffs the guinea pig down. And it's obvious at that point that, oh, he is going to be in deep trouble now, because he knows that they're obviously not anywhere near as human as they've been pretending to be. And of course, as it turns out, that yeah, they are reptiles wearing prosthetic skin. And yeah, it is just a much better series, and it's an analogy for cult of personality and cult of power, on how that can run amok and how people can allow themselves to be conquered without a fight.
Can I just ask?
Yeah.
Do you reckon David Icke watched this and thought it was a documentary?
Oh, God. He probably did. I've read some of his stuff and, oh, he is mad. He's mad as a box of frogs. Oh, did anyone see that documentary where it was John Ronson following him around on one of his book tours in America?
Nope.
One of the, is it National Anti-Defamation League in America, which is, I'm not sure whether it's a specifically Jewish organization, but it looks for anti-Semitism.
Okay.
And things like that. This is just quick, so don't worry. John Ronson was following him around, and the Anti-Defamation League were saying, we think when David Icke talks about lizards, it's actually code. He's talking about Jews and Zionism. And, of course, John Ronson, investigative journalist and author, he's Jewish. He was following David Icke around, and he came to the conclusion quite quickly that when David Icke talks about lizards and shape-changing and things like that, he really, really sincerely is talking about lizards and shape-changing. He is that mad. And there was an excellent scene where he was talking to one of the Anti-Defamation League representatives, and he was saying, no, he really is talking about lizards. He's not talking about Jews. But yeah, it is kind of like that. It is sort of, it is very David Icke.
Okay.
But in general, the original 80s miniseries is just far better thought out and far better done than the slow plodding remake retread that they're doing. And I have no idea why they're bothering with a new one. It's just, no. There's no comparison, really.
Okay, Paul B, do you want to talk about Sliders?
Okay, sure. Well, it's a series about a guy that managed to create a wormhole between parallel worlds, and he and three others basically slide from world to world. The original kind of point of it was to try and get back to their original world. Which they do visit once or twice, but things conspire and, they can't stay there. It stars Jerry Doyle. Is it Jerry Doyle? Jerry O'Connell, that's one.
Yeah.
I don't know where I got Q-ball. Doyle from. Yeah, Q-ball, exactly. I just think it's a fantastic series. It started out... as kind of one thing, but unfortunately, as what generally happens with Fox shows when it comes to things like this, is that Fox screws them over. Well, from what
goodness.
I've heard.
Well, didn't pretty they much. End up, so, the later seasons end up being produced and aired by a different channel, like Sci-Fi or something?
Yes, it was Sci-Fi channel from, I believe it's the fourth onwards. It kind of goes downhill midway through the third series where, spoilers, Professor Ortoro gets killed off.
Or Gimli. I had to get that in.
From there, there's kind of so many bad decisions in the script writing. He gets killed by a guy that has to steal people's spinal fluid and inject it into himself in order to stay alive.
Hang on, what?
Yeah.
Yes. It goes. It gets worse. It gets worse, right?
seem to recollect some of this. I watched Sliders for the first couple of seasons and then sort of drifted in and out. But
same here.
Well, it gets worse. Basically, the Cro-Mags, who are like alternate to humans who developed on a parallel world.
Now, I really liked that idea. Alternate hominids surviving in parallel worlds.
They're basically going around conquering alternate, parallel universes, including eventually Earth Prime, which is our world. Quinn Mallory finds out that he was actually not born from this world, but was sent here from a higher world, to avoid the Cro-Mags, and that he has a brother which was sent to a separate parallel world, which he then goes to seek out, and that's played by his actual real life brother. I know this is this is crazy. Yeah. I think at one point they try to get back to Quinn Mallory's original world, so the one that where he was a baby. Let's see what else. Oh yeah, and then at the start of the fifth series, basically because Jerry O'Connell and his brother quit because things were going terrible, they decided to fuse the two Quins into a single Quinn. That was stupid, and have another random woman on the show for the fifth series. And the fifth series hasn't actually been released in the UK, but the other four have. By the end, there was rumours basically that Sci-Fi weren't actually even reading the script. And the way that they knew was basically Sci-Fi had a rule about not showing, I think it's guns on screen or not showing people being shot or whatever. They actually found out that they weren't reading the studio weren't actually reading the scripts before going to film, by actually breaking one of those rules and actually managed to get it to air.
Right, so and make them.
You know, in a way, it's sad because at the beginning it had the potential to be Quantum Leap for a new generation because, you know, it's been made in the 90s and stuff. And then the mistreatment it suffered. It's just...
I don't understand why they suddenly mistreat shows like that. It's tough because there was so much potential there. I mean, I used to watch that because that was on BBC Two, I think.
Yeah, and
I used to watch it religiously, you know. And but it happens all the time. That's the annoying thing. It does happen all the time.
Suppose recent examples for that would be the treatment of things like Firefly and Dollhouse.
Yeah.
So. And Futurama.
Fringe as well. Fringe is. Got the reprieve of one last season, which is this last season, then it's going to be finished. And there is so much potential there as well, which is annoying. But hey ho, the telly bosses know what they're doing. Yay!
Yeah. I will just say little bit of trivia. Mm. Sliders is related by one of the creators to Star Trek Next Generation.
Ah, cool.
Tracy Torme.
Really?
Yes, right. Listed as one of the creators, and she's one of the writers on Sliders as well.
Yeah.
And of course, she was one of the staff writers on Next Generation.
Yes. Awesome.
Okay. Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Next Gen, but my favorite sci-fi show is definitely, I think, Farscape. Interestingly, used to air on the same days as Sliders, or it'd be on rotation with it during the week on BBC Two, and that's how I got introduced to it. I didn't actually start watching it from the beginning, which meant that everything was really confusing until Paul and I got our hands on the huge DVD box set. That had everything, including the Peacekeeper Wars. Mm. For those who somehow don't know, Farscape is about a guy from Earth who is with an, I think it's an Australian space agency.
Isn't it an international one?
I think was it international?
ISA or something.
IASA or something.
And basically he's looking at using sort of planetary slingshotting to travel in space, and ends up basically having his ship on the first test flight for this, which is just a small, it's not even really a proper shuttle. It gets swallowed up into a wormhole, and he ends up being taken on board this strange alien ship, and there's loads of aliens everywhere who all look very different and all sound very different. He doesn't know what the hell's going on. And then I would say that things really begin the moment one of the little robots on the ship injects him with a bunch of microbes that allow him to then understand any language that's spoken to him. And thus begins Farscape, really. But an Earth dude who ends up flying around a huge chunk of the galaxy trying to get away from an intergalactic peace force, and you can't see it, but there's double speech marks around the words peace force, and just trying to find a way home. Character's name's Crichton. The Doctor Who connection is that the same actor that played Crichton was the sheriff in this week's Doctor Who that's just gone.
Cool.
The trend is if people know what happens at the end of Farscape before the Peacekeeper Wars, there's the trend for that actor.
Okay.
But I dispute this trend because obviously Peacekeeper Wars.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to spoil Futurama. Not Futurama. Farscape. We almost have Futurama included on this list. Top five overall. Farscape was always interesting. I mean, it ran for, is it five seasons in the end?
Five seasons.
I believe it was four.
Well, that plus the Peacekeeper Wars miniseries. And basically, the thing about Farscape is that Crichton essentially ends up acquiring the knowledge for using wormholes to travel through space and, in some instances, time. And this causes all sorts of problems and also means that there's various factions in these alien parts of the galaxy that would like to... kind of cut open his noggin and kind of scoop out the information, which leads to some of the most interesting dissociative personality disorder portrayals I've ever seen on the telly.
Cool. Harvey.
Yes, Harvey.
Oh, God. I just like you, I started watching it and then, I only saw the first few episodes and it didn't really seem to be, going anywhere. So we stopped. And then, picked it up later on when people were saying, actually, it's, picking up quite a bit. And, Harvey was bloody confusing.
Yes.
Because it would be, walking along a corridor and then next thing, it would be Crichton and this weird skeletal character in a... some sort in leather mask.
I can't remember how to
bumper cars.
Yeah.
One example, just driving around in bumper cars and they'd be chatting and then it would go back to the ship and it would be, okay, there's something going on there. I don't know what.
I'm pretty sure that one scene that Crichton kept having in his head with Harvey was that they were kind of in the trenches or something and they're about to go over. There was a war setting. When the crap was about, shit was about to hit the fan, basically. So, yeah, and how do I explain why I like Farscape? And I think it was the fact that there was a huge variety of characters, and they really grounded a sort of technology mysticism angle quite well.
Yeah.
Which I really liked. And
also,
I like
also,
the
can
shit.
I just. Sorry.
I like more.
Can I. Can I also say that I think. One of the reasons why Farscape is actually quite good is basically because it's not a case of a crew exploring the galaxy. They've been basically exiled. So they're a renegade ship. They're running.
They are all convicts.
Exactly. And not all of the characters have something positive to add. You know, it's like
Rigel.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not like, oh, this situation, oh, this is my territory. Oh, this situation, oh, this is my territory. They, you know, not every character kind of adds the same amount, which I find actually quite interesting.
Hmm.
Do you know what? There's another reason to like Farscape, the puppetry and animatronics that they...
Pilot.
Yeah, Pilot. And Rigel's pretty damn good as well, actually.
Oh, Rigel works really well as a little puppet, but... Pilot is very impressive, especially when you see that he's so large and you do have the actors on the set interacting with him.
Yes.
And you've got all the arms going sliding over all the controls and they've got the character speaking. So I really liked him as a character.
I believe the guy that plays Captain Krace is also the guy that does the voice for Pilot, I believe.
He is, yes.
Lanny Tupu.
Yeah, which I'm not sure thought was absolutely fantastic.
Another reason to let Farscape properly introduce the world to Claudia Black.
Oh, Claudia.
There, yeah.
She's epic.
But now to talk about the one that basically everyone's kind of got a soft spot for, Star Trek, The Next Generation. Oh, Picard. Is still my beating heart.
Your teeth, Earl Grey. Hot.
And Data. Data is ace.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've got to admit, one of the things about the Star Trek, Next Generation, just the general universe in general, is that it's inspired science of today to kind of do stuff, you know, to kind of invent the technology, which I find is really... You know.
It has that in common with the original Star Trek, with all the people who, so many people who worked on mobile phones and things like that said that they really loved the idea of the Star Trek communicators.
Hmm.
Okay. Where it was, you know, especially the flip open phones. Yeah, about a decade ago or so.
Yeah.
I wonder how many people first got those phones and was like, Captain's Log.
Yeah.
What are you trying to say?
Nothing.
Things like the data pads that they'd carry around with.
Yes.
The only thing they really got wrong with the data pads was that they would have all the different data pads for different books. And of course, that's obviously not how you would do it, because anyone who's got ebooks, you have one device and you just choose a different book on it.
Or you have a not so powerful device that's basically actually like a thin client and you access cloud versions of everything.
Ooh.
Yeah. But I think there's a couple of characters, obviously long running characters in Next Gen that I liked. I mean, I actually quite liked Riker.
Yes. Make it.
I thought he was an excellent XO. He was.
It was so... I liked it because every series you seem to actually see a development of that character. It wasn't just stagnating there, doing nothing with it.
At the beginning, he had a risk of ending up a bit James T. Kirk, but by the end of it, he was very much not James T. Kirk.
He was definitely his own character.
Yeah.
Another one that came to the forefront was I liked the development of Worf as you went along, because in the very first couple of seasons when he was just
the Klingon.
Yeah, he was just the Klingon, and Tasha Yar's was it Underling?
Yeah.
Oh, Tasha.
That's first
season. Yes, Tasha Yar, Underling, and then he got made up to Chief of Security and got with Deanna Troi, and you know, it was just how that community intermingled with each other and kept on progressing with each other.
Well, it was the development of the Klingons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which you never really got with any of the other Star Trek. I mean, I'm rewatching the original Star Trek now, and yeah, the Klingons are just sort of Southern Asian Russian bad guys.
Yeah, pretty much.
To be fair, I think DS9 did actually go with the Klingons quite well.
It did.
It did. DS9
is very close second to Next Generation. Yeah.
And that's because they brought Worf in on season 3.
Season 4, I believe.
Is it season 4?
Yeah.
I think it's more season four than it is season three.
Okay. But you know, it was how they developed that, and it's also brought in one of my favourite baddies of all time as well, the Borg.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Resistance is futile. That was awesome.
And I know some people out there have been like, hey, who would win in a fight between Borg and Dalek? But I'm betting on the Borg.
Yeah. The Borg.
They'll assume they easily.
The Borg, I mean, you know, resistance is futile.
Mm.
So your biological and technological distinctiveness will adapt to service us.
Yeah. No, but there was so many little facets to the whole thing.
My favourite Star Trek film is a Next Gen one, and that's First Contact.
Yeah, it's got to be, hasn't it, really?
Those parts of Generations I liked, I have to say. They always stick out in my head.
To me, none of the Next Generation films really lived up to the promise or the best of the TV series. At its best, Next Generation was just about the best TV sci-fi you could get, especially at the time.
Yes.
Go on.
I was going to say, just to make people feel old, I do believe that Will Wheaton, who played the darling Wesley Crusher...
Mm-hmm. We all liked Wesley.
Yeah, just to make people feel old, I do believe he was 40 earlier this year.
Yes.
Just off to hang myself.
and he's got an adoptive son who I think graduated from college either this year or last year as well.
Yes, he did, yeah.
I follow him on Twitter and he regularly. Yes. It's just you're Wesley Crusher. How the hell do you have, you know, college age kids?
Yeah,
that's
what the hell's going on.
Because he adopted him when he was a couple of years old. That's why.
Yeah, but even so, he's not allowed. He still looks like Wesley Crusher. He looks like Wesley Crusher with a beard.
It is amazing. I mean, how much he's grown as well. It's scary.
I think, you know what's scary?
Mm-hmm.
I reckon if you compared Will Wheaton as he looks now to Riker, Will Wheaton could be Riker's younger brother.
Yeah.
Ooh, like first season Riker before the beard.
Yeah.
I was thinking more.
More with the beard.
After that. Well, yeah, with the beard.
Mm. Ooh. Oh dear. Oh God! I know I can see it. Oh. Yeah, I can see it in my head now.
Yes,
and I think on that note, it might be safe to say that is all we have time for this week. As we leave people with mental images and questions that only fan fiction has ever dared to ask,
and indeed successfully write about. Oh, not successfully. That's not the word I'd use. Ill-advisedly.
Obviously, people, you are very welcome to find us over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk and on Twitter at Nerds Podcast. We're also on Facebook at Nerds Assemble Podcast. And as I keep saying, we're also on Google+. I do try to update it. So it's goodbye from me. I'm Emily, of course. You can find me on Twitter at EK6891.
It's a good night from me, aka Retroid on Eurogamer.net or Super Retroid on Twitter.
And it's good night from me, Paul, aka OneArmed_Cookie on Twitter. And you can also find me lurking around thegamejar.com.
Okay, it's good night from me, Paul. The Paul Blewett, that is. And my Twitter name is Paul Blewett, and I have a website, paul-blewett.com, which mostly is my editing, video editing stuff.
So, goodbye from us.
Good night, all.
Good night.
See you next week.